Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan, coming to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
The way the NDIS is set up, things are categorised into different funding. So music therapy was in therapy support, and it is still now.
Music and art therapists will soon be able to bill the NDIS at the same rate as counsellors. Also,
a huge priority of mine is ensuring that our council is underpinned by a process of participatory democracy where all voices within our community have input into decision making.
We hear from the newly elected Alice Springs Mayor, Asta Hill, the first Greens candidate to hold office in the town council. And later today,
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students finishing year 12 rate was in 2021 at 68% compared to non-Indigenous, which is 91%.
A new initiative for young First Nations girls in the New England region of New South Wales. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, Australia has formally recognised Palestine as a sovereign and independent state, becoming one of over 150 nations to do so. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese announced the formal recognition at the United Nations General Assembly in New York to coincide with similar declarations made by the UK and Canada. Many have welcomed the move as historic, but say it must be matched with strong action and an end to Australia's military cooperation and two-way arms trade with Israel. Former Labor-turned-independent Senator Fatima Payman has remained a strong voice for the recognition of a Palestinian state since crossing the party floor in a vote on the matter last year. I spoke to Senator Payman to hear her thoughts on the declaration.
Oh, it's massively significant. I mean, to the point where, you know, me crossing the floor 15 months ago caused such a national crisis for the government that one of their own had called for something that was in their platform. Their members had been calling it for years. So it's definitely a massive, huge step in the right direction, but definitely not enough. And, you know, the government has a real opportunity to keep putting pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu to do what's right by the Palestinian people.
And like you said, it's significant, but doesn't seem strong enough. A lot of critics have said that this push for recognition is really only symbolic or a last-ditch effort, and recognition alone won't end the starvation or occupation. What power does recognition have if Australia still refuses to sanction Israel and end the two-way arms relationship?
Look, it is a symbolic move. And like I said, we do need to put pressure on Netanyahu to stop his genocide and the war crimes being perpetrated. The recognition will obviously put pressure not just on Netanyahu, but also on our own government to stop sending weapons and support to the Netanyahu government and, you know, really call out the defiance against international law that Netanyahu's been, you know, demonstrating and the end to weapons exports where there'd be a higher level of transparency that the government will have to show. You know, you can't just say we condemn the actions. You can't just say, you know, we've recognised Palestine and yet continue arming Israel and enabling this war machine because if that continues, then there will be no Palestine to recognise. So it's very important that the government actually matches these very strong words with real tangible action.
How likely do you think we are to see that kind of real tangible action, especially only a month ago? We saw Penny Wong say that Australia only supplies non-lethal parts for the F-35 fighter jets.
I'm just astonished and left speechless when the government say that it's a non-lethal part, because if those, if the doors that release the bomb or missiles, if that is not supplied by Australia, then the F-35 fighter jets won't even be able to be assembled together, which means that it would be incomplete and would not be then supplied to Israel. So it's deflection. I see it as the government just trying to placate the large population of Australians who want to see the genocide end, who want to see the killing and suffering and this illegal occupation to end, and to make sure that Australia is not complicit in it, you know, like whether it's on our shores or overseas, like we have a high standard as Australians when it comes to human rights, when it comes to human dignity. And I think that's what everyday Australians want to see our government do, not, you know, continue supplying all these weapons and continuing the military cooperation and then turning around and saying, well, we've recognised Palestine, so what more do you guys want? And that's where I say it's not enough. This is a step in the right direction, but it can't stop there.
There's concerns from the opposition, more specifically, that this decision to join other nations in recognising Palestine risks damaging Australia's relationship with the United States. What are your thoughts on that?
Australia has an independent foreign policy and we need to exercise that. We should not do what Donald Trump wants us to do. And yes, it requires a great deal of courage to stand against the US and the administration and say, look, we're going to do what's best for Australians. We're going to listen to our people, not necessarily what works for, you know, Donald Trump and his agenda.
And just finally, what message do you think this decision sends to the Palestinian diaspora in Australia?
That their advocacy matters and that their voice matters. You know, they have been calling for this for decades, you know, and again, this may be very symbolic, but it doesn't stop there. And I commend and applaud every single advocate around the country, whether they be from the Palestinian diaspora community or not, for standing up for humanity.
Senator Fatima Payman there, ending that report.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
Starting in November, music and art therapists will have the opportunity to bill the National Disability Insurance Scheme at the same rate as counsellors. On Wednesday, the government released the results of an independent review, showing the services are effective and can have an enormous impact for people living with a disability. The Wire's Thomas Kutis spoke to Associate Professor in Music Therapy at the University of Melbourne, Grace Thompson, and asked her to describe a moment when she saw a breakthrough with a client in music therapy.
Yes, well, I'm a registered music therapist and I've worked with children with disability for many, many years. And I'm using music making and music therapy methods to really promote a lot of developmental goals. So I think times where I've seen a breakthrough have been particularly with children who can be quite isolated and not engaged in the world. And through a more non-verbal musical interaction with a therapist, there's something that draws that child into the social interaction and engagement. And really, once we have attention and engagement, all kinds of developmental possibilities are open to us in music therapy.
How do you tailor creative therapies to meet the unique needs of individuals with different disabilities?
Well, this is a key part of our training. So registered music therapists have a two-year master's qualification and we have our key methods and techniques, which are all around live music making. Some receptive methods and listening to music, but it's really through that engagement with music. And alongside that, we do a lot of work to understand the strengths and challenges that people with different conditions might face. And so that's our job as a creative arts therapist, as a music therapist, to say, okay, I really want to work with this person's strengths or to address a challenge that they might have.
and to select the music therapy method that best aligns with that. And we keep evaluating and keep assessing how things are going for that person. So it's very much a therapeutic approach rather than an approach that's about engagement in music activity, which can also be really beneficial. But a therapist is looking to really tailor what they offer in a session to meet that therapeutic goal.
What do you wish more people could understand about the difference between recreational art and music and therapeutic practice?
Yeah, it's such an important question and issue for us. I think the challenge and the confusion is that when we engage in music and art, we can feel good from that. In a way, that can be a therapeutic experience, but that's not therapy as a profession. So, you know, I love going to live music, for example, and I'll come out and I know that my mood feels better, my energy feels better. I might even feel better for days. I might have connected socially with friends while I've gone to see a gig. But that's great, but not music therapy. So I guess the difference is that when people come to see a therapist, they're coming because they have a goal that they want to work on, that they have a need that they want to address. And we, as the therapist, really negotiate and partner with that person to create a plan for them to meet their needs. So for me, the media is the same. It's music, but the intention and the use of it is very, very different.
Now, there's been issues over the years with the VNDIS funding model. Has that affected your ability to provide these therapies? And what changes would you like to see with this funding model?
Well, I really, first of all, want to acknowledge that the National Disability Insurance Scheme has been a fantastic initiative for opening up access to therapy services for people with disability. I think many more people have been able to access music therapy because of the NDIS. We used to work it in community agencies, NGOs, various different locations, which had their own barriers. But the way the NDIS is set up, things are categorised into different funding. So music therapy was in therapy supports, and it is still now. The review by Stephen Duckett places us back in therapy supports. There's another category that's community participation, also a really important category in the NDIS, but it's not the same as therapy supports. So I think it's really important that the NDIS continues to give choice to people with disability to be able to choose whether they're looking for therapy or whether they're looking for community participation activities to be funded. Both are important. The qualifications and the evidence for each type of funding needs to be different.
Associate Professor Grace Thompson from the University of Melbourne there, speaking with The Wire's Thomas Kutis. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan in Brisbane. A big hello to our listeners in Armidale on 2ARM, to our friends in Alice Springs on 8CCC, and to the other side of the country on Radio Galari in Broome, Western Australia. In August, Alice Springs elected Asta Hill as their mayor, being the first Greens candidate to hold office in the town council. Although the area has seen a small drop in crime rates, there's a long way to go. So what will the local council do to make Alice Springs a safer town? The Wire's contributor from 8CCC, Kate Lyons-Dawson, spoke with Ms Hill about her plans and the challenges ahead of her tenure as mayor.
I think the initial challenge is getting to know my new colleagues. I've got 8 people who, you know, I am going to be really getting to know for the first time in a professional capacity. And we cut across the political spectrum, absolutely, come from a range of backgrounds and experiences And sitting on a council together, we are going to have to find common ground time and time again. So I think it'll be really important that those initial conversations that we have, where we get to know each other, our values and our priorities, those conversations need to be conducted really well so that we can have an amazing 4 years together.
That's very important, isn't it? The teamwork, because you want to be getting things done. Change would be one of the important things that you'd see needed here in Alice Springs.
Yeah, and I didn't hide about the campaign initiatives, the things that were really important to me in running a campaign. But I have to say that the initial priority is also to just keep getting the basics right.
Mm-hmm.
As I and the council, the new 15th council, get our heads around the machinery of local government.
There's a lot of learning that you've got to do, right?
Absolutely.
Plus, it'll possibly be a bit different, the reality of it, compared to what you were hoping, you know, like what you were putting forward as ideas that you would like to bring in.
You're totally right. Mm-hmm. I spent my first day as mayor at the council, it's all moving very quickly, which is so exciting. But yeah, I realised that I have so much to learn. The good thing is that I'm so up to that challenge. I love learning. I love new experiences. I love being in the deep end, especially when there are such capable people to lean on. And I've seen that already at the council. It's very... The council's staff are very experienced. It's a very stable workplace, and I think that's a really helpful thing in circumstances where we have so many new members sitting in the council itself.
Now, one of the things you did speak up about was around changing the voice or the idea of Alice Springs. Is that going to have to take a backseat while you settle in, or is it all going to be from day one that you're going to be pushing that sort of more positive image of Alice Springs out to the world?
Changing the story of the town, it started even before day one as mayor. It started with the campaign. I hit the ground running yesterday, and I've already been speaking a lot with media, and that is a message that I will consistently be spreading, because I also go into this role authentically as myself, and I'm going to express the views that I have about this town, which are overwhelmingly positive.
From past council meetings, it did become sort of obvious that there was some difficulty between the council and Laratipa. I'm not sure. It sounded like they were still in the mode of moving that. Is it going to be key for your first weeks, months, whatever, how long it takes to put these things into action, to bring that round again and to reach out to any of the key organisations in town to make sure that we are operating well as a community?
Relationships with the traditional custodians of Central Aranda Country, obviously the most important thing in getting right in sitting on this council. And that also extends to so many organisations in this town. I was really privileged to attend a forum that was facilitated also by the Disability Advocacy Service in the lead up to this election. And those communities are really keen to provide input into council decision making. I've spoken with a number of young people who also want to have more input. So I should say that relationships are absolutely going to be a priority in terms of preserving them and improving them. But also a huge priority of mine is ensuring that our council is underpinned by a process of participatory democracy, where all voices within our community have input into decision making, and that process is really accessible to them.
There's things to consider around weather here, including flooding, obviously Buffalo, both things that come in these sort of stormy events. How are you going to make sure that those things become higher up in the priorities for the council?
Climate adaptation, for one, is going to absolutely be a priority agenda for me and other councillors, as far as I'm aware. So, look, I'm expecting with the initial few meetings, we're going to be really getting on with business and getting to know one another. But it will be very early on in the piece that I certainly start raising these issues as a priority.
That was Mayor of Alice Springs, Asta Hill, speaking with ACCC's Kate Lyon-Dawson.
A different take on Australian current affairs. This is The Wire on your community radio.
A new initiative for young First Nations girls in the New England region of New South Wales will be rolling out over the next 5 years. Young Titters on Country will see First Nations girls in Armidale, Urala and Guyra supported culturally through years 4 to 9. Tune FM's Ash Taylor spoke to Cassie Strong, a consultant for agency Murrowin, which is leading the project.
Murrowin in the Dungari language means to be educated and be responsible with education. It is a family-led company and it's a national Indigenous consultants business based in Brisbane. Carol's connection to Armidale is that she was born and bred here as well and did most of her schooling here. So the connection for Murrowin to Armidale is through family.
So Young Titters on Country is about supporting primary school-aged girls in the Armidale, Urala and Guyra region. How was the need for this sort of program identified?
The need for this program came about with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students finishing year 12 rate was in 2021 at 68% compared to non-Indigenous, which is 91%. And we want to be able to help our people to be able to, you know, get through school and complete it and be able to go out into the workforce or uni to, you know, to better themselves and which will come back to our community and be able to help other family members. Our co-founder, Carol Vale, growing up in the Armidale area, didn't have any of this stuff when she was young, and I was in the same boat when I went to school. It wasn't there. So she thought this would be a really good program for Armidale to be able to do so that, you know, these girls especially get support and from people who will be able to help them through this. So it's a personal task that she wanted to do is to be able to, you know, give the support to the girls that she didn't get when she was at school.
How does, you know, bringing in those cultural connections help with a program like this?
The cultural connections will help with the program by having the girls find their cultural identity, and through this they'll be able to find, you know, like connections that they may not have known, and just getting to know more about what our elders and ancestors used to do, and, you know, how we're connected to the land, the water and, you know, the plants and all that kind of stuff. And I think it'd be really good in that way, because as someone who going to school, we didn't have any of those kind of programs. So we missed out on a lot of that. And that's probably one thing that I'm really excited about is to be able to help these girls learn this stuff and also myself learning things that I may not have known about. So I'm really excited about the cultural impact this program will have on our girls and myself.
When I was growing up and going through school, there were a lot of programs for First Nations boys and I never really saw any for First Nations girls. And so that's one of the things that stood out for me about this program is the fact that it's directly aimed at young Aboriginal girls in the area.
So the reason that that Annie Carol wanted to do this program is because the same what you've just said. She didn't get that when she was young. There was no programs for girls. And like I said, for myself, we didn't have any of those. So she's really passionate about empowering girls. And that's another aspect of Murrowin's business is empowering First Nation women and girls to, you know, move forward and be able to, you know, be confident and do things that they think that they can't do, but actually they can. Our aim is to make sure that these girls know about the support that we have in our community, as well as like nationwide for Aboriginal girls, that, you know, there are these things out there that they can do with guidance, support from people like myself and Birrali, who is another Murrowin staff member but working on this project with me.
Tune FM's Ash Taylor there, speaking with Cassie Strong from Murrowin. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening. wherever you are in Australia. The Wire has been produced today with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries on which this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan. As always, thank you so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.